comes this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait. There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family. Welcome to Crap of the Week.
Sweet, merciful crap!
That was the biggest load of crap I've ever heard.
Ah, crap!
We're at downtown Toronto headquarters. Here's episode 130, Crap of the Week. This is a segment where we spring movies on one another. Something that maybe one of us has seen and the other hasn't, because we see so many movies and we need a segment to do this. So we're going to launch right into it. What is the crap? Not necessarily crappy. Could be good. We don't know. It's just a title, folks, just like our website. What did you see this week?
Well, the one I saw was crappy good.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about 1985's epic blaxploitation martial arts musical, The Last Dragon.
Oh, one of those. Oh, if I had a nickel. Okay, great. Well, that sounds fantastic.
Otherwise known as Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
Wow, the Motown kingpin himself.
For sure.
Wow. So am I safe to assume this has incredible music?
You know what? It does. Nothing to the extent of, like, you know, The Tears of a Clown, or Reach Out, I'll Be There, or What Becomes of the Broken Hearted, but there's some pretty
nice,
amazing songs, one of which I love, and we're going to just play a snippet of right about now. Was produced by Motown Studios in the 80s, at least 70s perhaps, in the 80s, Barry Gordy decided to reach out into the world of movie making. I believe they produced a film starring Diana Ross called Lady Sings the Blues, which was a fairly decent-sized hit. And then this one, which came out in 1985, and it's funny because I don't recall, I mean, I'm a child of the 80s, but I don't recall ever seeing an ad for this movie or hearing about it. And yet, it didn't do too badly. It's, as I said before, it's a blaxploitation kung fu musical. And it's about a guy, it's really, really bizarre. You have this guy, and he's been training under the tutelage of some Asian kung fu master for all these years, and his name is Leroy, but a lot of people call him Bruce Leroy, okay?
Yes.
And there's a lot of Bruce Lee references in this movie.
And there's lots of Bruce Leroy's, right? In the world of cinema, there's lots of Bruce Lee knockoffs in the world of cinema as well. Like, there is, when he died, everyone was Bruce Lee.
Right.
It was a name that people took on. But, oh, this sounds great already. I'm excited.
So Leroy, so at the beginning of the movie, during opening credits, we see Leroy, and he's played by an actor by the name of Tamak. One word, Tamak.
Hmm.
I looked at IMDb. The man has done a few other things here and there. This film came out in 85. His next picture came out in 89. I don't know why he didn't become bigger, because not only does he have the martial arts bona fides, but he's a very charismatic young man. And so Tamak is doing, you know, your requisite kicking and punching. And then when the credits are over, we see him training with his master. And a la American Ninja, his master's shooting arrows at him, and he's deflecting them.
Nice.
Catching them, deflecting them. And then the master says, "You have now reached the final level."
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
Of course.
But Tamak, Leroy, I'm going to probably be calling him Tamak throughout this discussion. He's like, "But master, I don't..." And he had this really soft-spoken voice. He reminded me a lot of, like, you know, a young Michael Jackson. "But the master, I don't feel it. And you always mentioned that when I would reach the final level, I would find the glow." And so his master says to him in, you know, very stereotypical broken Chinglish.
Yeah, fortune cookie English, yeah.
It's amazing you say that, because he goes, "In order to find the glow, you have to go to some dumb guy, the new master..." And it's a fortune cookie company.
Huh.
You're given this medallion, and this medallion was once owned by Bruce Lee, and he will teach you the glow. So apparently when you learn, when you reach the utmost level, the 36th chamber, you get the glow. So Leroy is quite disappointed. He's like, "How do I know? How am I going to know when I find the master?" And he's sort of like this naive kind of babe in the woods. I mean, he's been on a tutelage of this master for all these years. Now, this movie takes place in New York City. So the master has basically said to Leroy, "My tutelage with you is over. You now must search for another master." So in the next scene, we see Leroy walking up from the subways of New York City dressed like a Vietnamese rice farmer. He's got those silk pajamas.
Yes.
He's got that,
triangular hat, whatever it is. Yeah,
that's sort of the wicker hat. He's walking down the streets of New York City, and he goes to a grindhouse theater where they're screening a Bruce Lee movie. I believe it was Fist of Fury or something.
Mm.
And at the beginning, we don't know he's in the theater, because we just see this grindhouse cinema, and there's a Bruce, you know, Bruce Lee's up on the big screen, and this is just nuts. I mean, all of a sudden, some idiots decide to lay down a boombox and start breakdancing in the middle of the aisle. This, of course,
it was the 80s.
It was, 1985. And one guy gets up and he karate kicks a boombox. And then this gang walks in. And the leader of the gang is a 6'3" black gentleman with a handlebar mustache and a sort of Gene Simmons-esque kabuki hairstyle. And he's wearing a cape that looks like it was made from tiger skin. And he's sort of like the scourge of the neighborhood. And he's got two names. Shonuff. The Shogun of Harlem. And he walks in, and he's got this whole spiel. He goes, and he's got these cronies, these henchmen. He goes, "Am I the baddest?" And they go, "Shonuff! Am I the meanest? Shonuff!"
Call and response. "Am I the prettiest?
Shonuff!" And this goes on and on and on.
No show kasugi to be found.
And people are upset that he's interrupting the movie. And one kid goes, "Somebody's going to take you on, Shonuff. I know who's going to take you on. Bruce Leroy Green sitting over there." And there he is in those silk pajamas, and he's eating popcorn with chopsticks.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
Hilarious. I'm just like, what in the fuck is going on here? Now, this becomes a melee? How do you pronounce it?
Melee?
This becomes a melee. And everybody in the cinema apparently knows Kung Fu. And as they're fighting, and Shonuff and his cronies are kicking the shit out of everybody, Leroy makes his escape. He doesn't fight. So, there's that. Now, I thought that, you know, because he was on a tutelage with this master, perhaps he was orphaned or pinned, like in Miami Connection. No, he's got a family. He's got a brother. He's got a mother and a father who own a pizza joint in the Bronx, like Papa Green's Pizza Joint, and he's now living with his parents, and he's got his little brother, who is hilarious. He just insults, he has no respect for his grown brother. And the funniest kind of racially tinged insults you'd ever want to hear. For example, calling him a walking fortune cookie, or saying, you know, you're a ping pong playing chow mein for brains kung fu head, that sort of stuff. Now, you would think that Show Enough would be Show Enough adversary for one movie, but there's another adversary, and his name is Eddie Arcadia. And he's this nefarious music producer. And he wants to, and there's this, like, I don't know, Solid Gold, American Bandstand type show that's hosted by a lady by the name of Laura. And she's played by Vanity, the late Vanity, ex-Prince Paramore. Mm-hmm. She was also Never Too Young to Die. And they play rock videos, and people dance to it.
It's not like a Soul Train thing. It's like a rock thing?
Well, rock video, soul video. Okay. See, in the 80s, it was all the same. Yeah. It was music, right? And it's funny, too, because when I started watching the movie and I saw Leroy, I thought to myself, he kind of reminds me a bit of El DeBarge. Remember El DeBarge?
I do, indeed.
And then, suddenly,
the video DeBarge shows up?
Yes! and we have this, the screen is Philip DeBarge, and they're singing Rhythm of the Night.
Mm.
Philip E. the Rhythm
of the Night. That's a great era of music. Between that or like Cameo, like Word Up and all that, like 80s soul and funk and rap. It was just exciting time.
Just wonderful stuff. And the soundtrack is good because you got some of that, you know, electro pop going. You got some of that rap in there. You got the break dancing. This character, Leroy, he's completely guileless. He doesn't know the ways of the big city. He's got this brother that's always ripping into him. The brother, who looks to be all of like 6 or 8, he's got this crush on Laura, Vanity, and Leroy gets the eyes for Vanity. And the brother says to him, "You don't know what you're doing. You can't do anything with that girl. There's an art to making love, and you don't even have a paintbrush." And later on, when, of course...
Good line.
There's so many great lines in this. When Leroy and Vanity, you know, they start to get a little hot and heavy, Leroy actually says to her, "I don't know what I'm doing. I don't even have a paintbrush."
Oh, wow.
Hilarious. Now, so we have Show Enough, and Show Enough is constantly terrorizing Leroy, and Leroy refuses to fight him because, of course, to know kung fu is to not use it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Show Enough goes so far as destroying the Papa Green's pizza place, and then we have this Eddie Arcadian guy, and he wants to get this video played on Laura's show, and she refuses to play the video, so he's kidnapped not once, not twice, not thrice, like 4 times, and Leroy has to keep coming to a rescue. When he comes to a rescue, he dresses as a ninja. This movie has it all.
Yeah.
Ultimately, he needs to prove his mettle by beating Arcadian, beating Show Enough, and finding the glow. And without spoiling too much of the movie, when he does have his climactic fight with Show Enough, and dude, you gotta see what this guy Show Enough looks like. In fact, another insult that somebody once levies at Show Enough is they call him something along the lines of a string bean Rick James looking motherfucker. This movie's got it everything. He finds out that Show Enough has the glow, and as he's fighting, he starts glowing red, and he's punching Leroy, Bruce Leroy Brown, and it's like a laser light show because these red lasers are flying everywhere. But then Leroy learns that he didn't need to find another master. He was the master all along.
Ooh, boy.
And, and the glow was inside of him. So he gets the golden glow. So we got the golden glow versus the red glow, and they're punching each other, and it's a laser light show, and it's just lunacy. At one point, he catches a bullet with his teeth, and there's so much going on in this movie. You got these jive-talking Asian fortune cookie employees. It's unbelievable. And it's a wicked soundtrack. I kind of love this movie. It was a goofy, only in the 80s type of movie that has everything you would want. I mean, as I said before, you know, blaxploitation, kung fu, musical, El DeBarge is in it, Rhythm of the Night. It's
nice to see an evil record company executive as well, as we podcasted the Canon production, The Apple. Mm-hmm. So anytime you know, some producer is involved. It just adds up. There's basically, you know, spaghetti theory filmmaking, right? They needed music in it. They wanted kung fu. They needed Asian guys. They're just multi-demographic pitch here. Let's throw everything into this movie.
That's the thing, too, because this record executive, this Arcadian fellow, I mean, he's kidnapping Laura left, right, and center, and there's a body count. People are starting to, you know, perish. All because of a video. Because he wants a video of one of his artists played on his show, and she refuses to play it. Play the goddamn video!
Yeah, whatever happened to payola? You just pay someone and that's it. You don't need a kill and don't need a body count.
Yeah. So, I mean, this movie was goofily endearing. Shonuff has quickly become one of my favorite movie characters of all time. Lines worthy of Dolomite. Just a wonderful, wonderful, unhinged piece of 80s cheese. And I really don't know why Tamak didn't become a bigger star, because he was, like I said, really charming.
It just sounds like a rapper, and there's also like a Toronto Raptor basketball player named Tracy McGrady, and his nickname was T-Mac. So whenever I hear Tamak, and it's just a okay, you're always in a precarious position when you give yourself one name, because if you don't fly, like, it's over. Like, you can do it if you're Britney, Cher,
Madonna.
Mm-hmm. Taylor Swift, right now, she's a one name. Tamak? No. You got to have a few films under your belt before you adopt the one name.
What's really funny is that this film was top-lined by not one, but two one-named actors. Tamak and Vanity. And Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
Oh, my.
So, I don't think there was much in the way of Motown film productions after this one, but hilariously lunatic film, wonderful soundtrack. Really, really enjoyed watching this one.
Wow. And a star rating.
Oh, geez, man. I wasn't even prepared to give it one. Lots of Bruce Lee references. At one point, Tamak is, or Leroy is teaching his students how to, the art of Kung Fu. And he's wearing the exact same yellow tracksuit that Bruce Lee wore in Game of Death.
Yes.
We even have Ernie Reyes Jr. in this movie. Do you know Ernie Reyes Jr.? This little pint-sized kid. He was in the 80s. He was on a TV show called Sidekicks. Does that ring a bell?
Yes. Yeah. Wow. I haven't thought about this in 30 years. I used to watch it.
Yeah. And he was this awesome kung fu guy. And he was all of like 12 when this movie was made. And he was actually one of the fight choreographers. And he's in the climactic battle kicking some ass. So, yeah. I mean, this is sort of spaghetti theory filmmaking. But, man, entertaining is all get out. Wow. I'm going to give it just for the fact that this is a man walking the mean streets of New York City in the 80s, pre-gentrified, pre-Julianified, and he's wearing, you know, the silk pajamas and that, like, conical rattan hat. I'm going to give it 3¾ stars.
Nice.
Barry Gore's Last Dragon. And I hear that they're trying to remake this movie. Don't do it.
Huh.
This could only have been made in the 80s. You can't. Just stay away from The Last Dragon. It was a great one. What do you got?
Well, from the Big Apple, we go to the state that, pound for pound, is disproportionately represented in horror film. This is probably the most, perceived to be the most backward, whiskey still, cross-eyed, inbred, hick state in the entire U.S. This is, of course, West Virginia. This was, I believe, where Tucker and Dale were hanging out. This is coal miner's daughter territory. This is the wild hills of West Virginia. This is Wrong Turn. And this is a franchise of horror films that I had to watch because, not the whole franchise, God forbid, but it was one of these things that kept coming up. And it kept coming up. It's like, why are there so many Wrong Turn movies? Mm-hmm. Why have I not seen any of them? I have to right this wrong. This is just awful. Yeah, and I have to see this.
I did see the... Are you talking about the first Wrong Turn?
The first Wrong Turn. I think it was 2004. In the mid-2000s.
I saw Wrong Turn in 2004, and I don't recall a single thing. The only thing I recall is that Eliza Dushku was in it. Am I correct in that assumption?
I don't recall.
She was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, I'm not sure. I just know there was a chick from Entourage in it.
Okay.
Who was the love interest of E, which is the manager of these two idiots in Entourage, which is not a great show, but she was in it, a Canadian actress, and...
Oh, is that Emmanuel?
Emmanuel Shariki, who is incredibly gorgeous, and like a Moroccan Jewish chick, who's just stunning, and the lead actor is an awful character, I think. He is just a one-note goofball from Dexter, which is a terrific show that went entirely to seed.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it just went awful. This was the character Quinn, who was the love interest of Deb. Deb being the sister who single-handedly ruined Dexter.
As a Quinn, I hated that character.
Yeah, Quinn was an awful character. He's the lead here in Wrong Turn. He's this med student who's going to look for a job in Raleigh, North Carolina. Much like Children of the Corn, where we have a medical student who's looking for work on, you know, in another far-flung locale. He's driving around, gets lost. He's late for his interview with some hospital or whatnot. Naturally, there's a detour. There's a carnage on the road. The movie sets up the rural-urban divide. He goes to ask a trucker, "Look, man, what's going on the road up ahead?" The trucker, not exhibiting any southern hospitality at all, "This guy's an asshole," tells the doctor, "Hey, that's some nice hair gel you got in your hair," you know? Like, dismisses him entirely, tells him to fuck off. He goes to a roadside gas station inhabited by your typical gas station attendant with one tooth.
I was going to say, like, toothless.
He's toothless, one tooth, which just reminds me of my favorite, absolute favorite episode of The Simpsons, where the workers at the Springfield Nuclear Power Plant protest Monty Burns in order to get their dental plan back. And this has a terrific musical performance by Lisa doing a performance of a famous guitar piece that his name escapes me now. And Lenny, or Carl, I get them mixed up.
Lenny White, Carl Black,
it says. You know, dental plan, Lisa needs braces, dental plan. And Homer hears this and starts to advocate for the dental plan. And then this makes me laugh because there's a hick in the town of Springfield who says that the dental plan saved Old Chomper, which is what he refers to, his one tooth, which sticks out, and then he opens a beer with his one tooth. So in this backwoods gas station, there's a guy with one tooth, and he's not helpful at all, makes fun of this med student. Med student leaves in a huff. These backwoods people are no help at all. He goes on Bear Mountain Detour, starts driving through the woods to try and get a shortcut so he can get to his job interview. Around the bend, he reaches down for a CD to change his music, and of course, bam, he smashes into something in his path, and that something is a Jeep, which is sitting in the middle of the road because it's had its wheels taken out by barbed wire. So this is a group of co-eds, college people, who have gone on a bicycle trip, and they've had their ride sabotaged. Chris, the med student, rams into their vehicle, smash, boom. They interrogate him, say, "What the fuck, man? You just killed our ride. You're going to have to pay for this. You smashed all our bikes. They were going on a mountain bike excursion." Now they're stuck. Not that this vehicle was roadworthy before, but they were looking for help. They're stuck on the road. All of them have to now leave, get out of the backwoods, and go seek help, because now they have two smashed vehicles right in the middle of the road, and one person has obviously sabotaged them with this barbed wire. Now, interestingly, West Virginia is substituted by Hamilton Mountain, which is, Hamilton is like...
In my head I'm just thinking...
The shitty musical.
Yeah, West Virginia, I'm thinking, was it Rock Mount Denver or something?
Oh, Colorado, Rocky Mountain High, okay. Well, I was thinking you were thinking the musical Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, but this is like, think, I don't know, industrial place in the
Pittsburgh,
yeah, or here, yeah, Pittsburgh.
Or Liverpool,
yeah, like industrial town, although we like it, and we recently interviewed the proprietors of
our special effects, buddy Carlos Enrique,
the butcher shop. Yeah. So Hamilton is a kind of a, you know, dark city, and it's nearby, it's got, you know, a Hamilton Mountain, and this is where they filmed it, adequately representing the hills of West Virginia here. So of course, naturally, the two stoners hold back because they're lackadaisical, lazy stoner types. This thing needs a body count. They smoke some weed. What happens when you engage in vice in a horror film? She also blows the guy. Naturally, their lifespan is going to be curtailed precipitously. She blows him. They smoke. They're both smoked. Done for. Killed. And then we're left with, again, this Chris, med student and this aforementioned hot chick from Entourage and a couple others. They're traipsing through the woods. Of course, they come upon a cabin. Here is where we can get some help. They start searching the cabin, which they refer to as a garage sale from hell. If you've seen any horror films in the last 20 years, you know what a cabin in the woods has. It's got buzzing flies. It's got chimes. It's got...
You gotta have the chimes.
You gotta have the chimes. Yeah, it's ominous. Yeah. And, of course, you have to have pickle jars of gross stuff inside it. So, in this case, dentures or maybe teeth. They look inside it, and they're attacked by one of three cannibal hillbillies living in this town. They have to, of course, escape. So this is your pretty standard run-of-the-mill exploitation film. It's directed by Rob Schmidt, a guy who gave us The Alphabet Killer, which I've not seen, but anything based on a real-life serial killer I'm into, because I kind of like the Zodiac Killer and that kind of... Anyone with a weird MO, I'll probably check it out. He's got good visual style here. Again, not anything you haven't seen before, but there's some funny instances in it, and good performances, because Emmanuel Shiriki is fantastic. She's beautiful.
She was also in one of the few Adam Sandler comedies I really, really like.
Zohan?
Yeah, Don't Mess with the Zohan.
Yes.
That movie was hilarious.
Like, interesting.
He plays a lot. But I'm going to go on a limb here and say, like, I'm pretty sure, because I remember back in 2004, I had a mad crush on Eliza Dushku.
Huh.
And I'm pretty sure she was a final girl. Was Shiriki the final girl in this movie?
No, she got an... Ooh, a spoiler. Yeah. She got an axe to the throat, or whatever it was, in this forest. Boom, the axe comes out, and she's done for.
Because this movie came out, you know, right in that sort of post-Scream era of horror, when every horror film had to have some sort of telekinetic TV star to be like the final girl, whether it was your Neve Campbell's, your Jennifer Love Hewitt's, or
yes.
I don't know what you did last summer, and your Eliza Dushku from...
Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I'm not sure, but this also had the de rigueur in that period when you started to get into the torture porn elements with your Saw and whatnot, which around the same period where you had one of the characters killed with a bear trap, and the bear trap became the go-to weapon of choice for any of these films, and whether it was, I think it was used in Hostel as well, if I'm not mistaken, and...
Yeah, I do recall this one being fairly brutal.
Yeah, and I'm pretty grossed out by anything with moving parts. It's interesting. I was thinking about means of killing people, and
how often do you think about means of killing people, Chris?
Quite often,
should
in
I
fact.
Get
yes.
Okay.
Not anyone in particular.
Are you keeping a list? Am I on that? No. Okay.
Well, no. Kill list notwithstanding, we do. We obviously co-authored a book about horror kills, and I was thinking, what makes killing implements so scary? And given that everyone has a super sharp knife in their kitchen, and everyone uses a knife to chop vegetables and meat and everything, it's not really anything you associate.
Broccoli?
Yeah, chopping broccoli.
Yeah,
but a bear trap is something that's really sinister. I think traps, anything with moving parts, I think is automatically scarier. So a knife to the gut, big deal, it's a knife, but getting caught in a bear trap is pretty gross, and having to, when you're trying to survive and you're caught in it and you have to pry it loose, and it's, you see your own exposed flesh and you pretty much know this thing is going to be gangrenous and infected big time. It's meant for like a, you know, 800-pound grizzly, and it's on your leg. That automatically scares you. This movie, there's actually a Deliverance reference when these troop of idiots actually visit the cabin. And one of them suggests as much, that maybe should get going. Again, the garage sale from hell. They're set upon by, again, the aforementioned bear traps. They're getting arrows shot at them, and they're getting axes. You know, they're the subject of axe attacks. There's three cannibal hillbillies in the woods. So, well, this is by no means revolutionary stuff. It's a hybrid of Deliverance with maybe Friday the 13th crossed with who knows what, any cabin in the woods, don't go in the woods, that kind of movie.
The Hills Have Eyes,
a little bit of that as well.
But
again, some kind of neat performances. I will watch Emmanuel Shiriki in anything, and by anything I mean crop top, bikini, and short skirt. Like, she's stunningly beautiful. Not much to say for this film, other than there is a funny bit. There's some good choice writing where they talk about a couple of the people are going to be betrothed soon, and they're talking about who they should have as their wedding singer. Speaking of Adam Sandler. And one of them says, we should probably go with a Frank Sinatra singer and not a James Brown, because anyone who tries to ape James Brown is going to be probably pathetic. So there's some little funny lines where they get more involved in the characters than I thought. Otherwise, pretty straightforward, pedestrian. They make some good use of the Hamilton Mountain for some aerial kills and pairing fears that a lot of people have, which is getting attacked and killed, but also heights. So fear of heights plays into this thing. Mm-hmm. Probably a 3 out of 5, because it's a fairly standard Lost in the Woods movie, but with some good choice dialogue, some good filmmaking too. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm still trying to get my head around how this spawned. I think we're up to, what, 4 or 5 movies.
You know what? I know for what the fuck? There's a Wrong Turn 6. Oh. I mean, this thing has kept going and going. I saw the first, and I don't think any of the sequels ever got a theatrical release. I think it went straight to video. Wrong Turn 2, Wrong Turn 3, Wrong Turn 4, Wrong Turn 6. There may even be a 7 for all I know.
And I've always wondered too, when you're being attacked out in the woods, of course you have the tension of getting lost in the woods, but I would rather just walk randomly into the woods and not follow any kind of trail and just hope for the best that you're going to emerge from the woods in a survival kind of situation, rather than just following a trail and being hunted by some maniac who invariably knows everywhere you're going to be. The woods are massive, and yet killers know them like the back of their hand. For some reason, no one ever gets lost in the woods that they can't just disappear. It's easy to disappear and get lost and not be found in the woods. Hmm. And yet, killers have this preternatural ability to track you down. It's hard to track someone down in the woods. I'm a huge fan of a local guy here. He's got a show. I don't know if it's on anymore.
I was going to say,
Survivor Man.
Survivor Man.
Yeah, he's just a Les Stroud, who's a survivalist. He's an Ontario guy, and he goes and exposes himself for week-long excursions into the most remote, barren locales all over the world, whether it be Antarctic, the Serengeti, most recently in the Carpathian Mountains in Transylvania, which is great. And he just goes and survives. And he makes his own fires, he traps his own animals. And really, how hard can it fucking be to escape a killer who is a backwoods killer who lives in a log hut? Just go into the woods, pick any direction, and you're gone. Anyway, if you're going to starve to death, I would rather die out in the woods than be massacred by some creep.
I'll tell you what, a few weeks ago we podcasted The Burning, and I was telling you about Jungle Boy and Alfie Taylor.
Yes.
I do believe that they exist. I will drive you 3 hours north of Toronto. I will drop you in the Halliburton Woods.
Okay.
Okay? And
I will surely succumb to the elements.
You to your own devices.
Yeah, okay,
and
fine.
I'm going to stick Jungle Boy on you and see what happens.
Okay, you can always start a fire and someone will come to you for you eventually, especially since these
Chris
people...
Chris can't start that fire.
Especially since these people had their vehicle stopped in the middle of this deserted road. Just go the other direction. These three cannibals will not track you down. Odds are, always separate. Do not stay in one group, because that never helps you. These are lessons we've learned time and time again in horror films. And yet these people do not learn. They all stick together, which means they can be more easily tracked through the brush, because you have your tracks and whatnot. Anyway, these people never learn.
And just get back to my movie. One thing I've learned is that if you're looking for the glow, the final level, you don't need to find a master. You don't need to go to some fortune cookie company run by 3 jive-talking, weed-smoking, dice-playing Asian guys. The glow is within you all along.
Okay.
You are the last dragon.
Indeed.
So we've got two somewhat eclectic movies today.
For sure. Just completely different genres and time periods, and well worth watching on both fronts, even if... Again, exploitation, it's getting a little old with the gas station attendant who's inbred and everything.
Are you going to explore Wrong Turn 2 through 6?
I'm not going to go through 6, but I want to see, part of me wants to see what they do in Wrong Turn 2 to see how they further develop these monosyllabic, grunting, cannibal hillbillies further. So, sure, I will. And maybe we will see Last Dragon Redux if they do reboot this thing. I don't know who would or why, But you just can't reproduce the era when electronic music, nascent electronic punk and dance and rap was all coming together in this city that never sleeps. And in one time, you cannot do it now. You know, it would not have any resonance.
The thing is, like, I mean, T-Mac, I don't know where they found this guy. I don't know where he's gone to, but he had a good screen presence. He knew his martial arts. You know, obviously, if they're going to remake this, they're going to go the urban route. And I could just see them casting somebody like Chris Brown or Usher or, you know, Jason Derulo or something. It would just be terrible.
Jeez.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Well, maybe they could conjure up that post-apocalyptic wasteland that is present-day Detroit and keep the Motown flair going. Because there's lots of... Detroit is being overtaken by brush and wilderness as the city's continues its inevitable population decline. Maybe that would be the place to set it. Who knows?
Interesting enough, too, also, Busta Rhymes paid homage to Shownuff.
Anytime Busta Rhymes comes up in a podcast, you know, it's just great. Oh,
yeah, good God. It was in the... Woo-ha, woo-ha. Mm. Remember that one? Got you all in check? That Busta Rhymes video from about 10 years? Mm. Yeah, he played homage to Shownuff. And Shownuff was quite the character. So, who's the baddest?
Shownuff?
Who's the meanest?
Dolomite. No, Shownuff. Okay. Okay. I was going to say. I don't think we need to hear from Mr. Busta anymore.
So, yeah, two interesting movies. One that you hadn't seen. I have seen Wrong Turn, but it was a long time
and
ago.
And you had forgotten about it.
Totally forgotten about it.
Understandably, yeah.
So, yeah.
And The Last Dragon, a poster for which I had seen, because when we talk about being children of the 80s, there's posters that stick with us. It was such an integral part of what the movie going experience and decision-making on what to see. And it's the evocative poster for Gremlins. I still remember it. It was such... fondness, and also American Ninja. These are the two most iconic posters that drew me in, and I said I had to see both of these because of that. And
well, that's another topic for a podcast altogether. The lost art of the poster.
Yeah, no pun intended. Yeah, for sure.
Because, you know, they nowadays all they do is Photoshop a few heads together.
Yeah.
And call it a poster, whereas back in the day they were evocative, there was something else.
Yeah,
and
now it's just a thumbnail on Netflix, and who exactly really gives a crap? Yep. But this was integral stuff. So anyway, we're going to revisit this segment because we're seeing so many movies and we can only talk about so many, and it's always interesting when we don't know what the other person has seen, and you get these two very divergent films, and this is the kind of thing we like to keep going. So if you have any suggestions, fire us off an email at reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com, and we'll have more crap or not crap, as the case may be, for you very soon. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Thank you.